To aid my work, I picked up little pebbles and stones which, when held in the left hand, served as models to stand for the large boulders and rocks constituting the materials of the piece. Delving into the stone's character, examining its pits and depressions, outgrowths and protrusions, its subtle color nuances, its veins and its fissures, I experienced a way of seeing that had never occurred to me before. At first hearing, Aaron Borod's fascination with the minute might sound like a retreat from the larger world, and yet it led to a whole new approach for a major American artist. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Aaron Borod was a painter, sculptor, printmaker, ceramicist, and illustrator, but in 1953, the 46-year-old artist decided to devote himself to just one genre. After a career that ranged from urban landscapes to the ravages of the Second World War to Wisconsin's barns and swamps, what prompted Borod to spend his last 30 years painting still lifes? What led him to that blend of fancy and the literal known as magic realism? And what do some of those dreamlike paintings mean? Our guest is Randall Berndt, co-director of the James Watrous Gallery of the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters at the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison, and curator of the exhibit, Aaron Borod, A Life and Still Life.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I know you're a practicing artist as well as someone that does curating. And I'm curious, when you put together this centennial celebration of the work of Aaron Borod, what made you think that this was needed and that this was a figure that deserved more attention?
Well, first let me say that Aaron Borod was a fellow of the Wisconsin Academy. The Watrous Gallery is a program of the Academy, and Borod was made a fellow in 1984. He had quite a connection with the Academy. Many of his paintings were reproduced on Academy publications like the cover of the Wisconsin Academy Review. And so he had a presence with the Academy. He was very important in the Madison community. And since his death in 1992, he's been somewhat neglected. And, you know, in conversation with the family, the Borod family, Neil Borod lives here in Madison. We decided that it was time now at the centennial of his birth. He would have been 100 years old. We decided it was time to revisit his life and his art and to bring him back to the public again.
For someone who's never heard the name Aaron Borod, what would you say is the most important thing to know off the bat about this figure?
The important thing to come away with after seeing the exhibition, and I think people will, is what an amazing and interesting life Borod had and how that affected his art, and his life and his art woven together are the thing that really interested me and that I hope that we've put on the walls in the gallery.
And you can, by the way, look at some of the pictures, the images, what we'll be talking about during this hour, by going to our website at wpr.org. He came from the Chicago area?
Yes. Aaron Borod was born and raised and spent his young adult life almost into midlife in Chicago, was known as a Chicago painter. His work kind of came under the rubric of American scene painting, landscapes, cityscapes mostly. He came back to Chicago in 1930 after studying at the Art Students League in New York with John Sloan, who was a well-known and charismatic teacher whose paintings of his urban paintings of sort of the nitty-gritty street scenes were brought back by Borod to Chicago. And Borod really did for Chicago what John Sloan did for New York City. And Borod had an amazing career as that kind of painter and was really Chicago and Borod kind of went together, and his images of sort of back streets and the rough and tumble areas of Chicago were what people would think of him as. And then he came to Wisconsin, and many of us think of him as a Wisconsin artist.
How did he go about, or Sloan for that matter, doing those nitty-gritty street scenes? I mean, it sounds like it could be dangerous if you set up your easel there in the street. Did he use photography, right, or how did he approach it?
In those days, I think Borod worked mainly from sketches. He worked all the time. He was a prodigious painter as well as involved with drawing scenes. He would go out with a sketchbook, and I think he then transferred his drawings to paintings, but a lot of his work was a combination of mental images with what he had in drawings. And later, of course, he worked from still life with the work with the subject right in front of him.
And how would you describe the style at that point?
The American scene paintings in Chicago, they're loosely painted, lots of street scenes, people in environments. But as has been described, what Bullrod really portrayed was Chicago itself. I mean, mostly through architecture and street scenes. He did portraits. He did a lot of night scenes too, where the street would be lit up with shop lights and street lights. He did so many of these paintings that after a while he refused to do them anymore. He became known kind of as this painter of night lights and these very moody street scenes with those lights.
I was struck by, there's an article about him in the Wisconsin Academy, and I was struck by the account of how he took a course in how to draw. It comments, Bullrod was born on the near west side of Chicago in 1907, drew intuitively from a very early age, doodling wildly, trying to render faces and objects and copying characters from comic strips. A little later, after seeing an ad in the back of a magazine, he took a how-to-draw correspondence course. His father, who had been a cigar maker, opened a grocery store, and it talks about how the grocery store provided a source of a lot of the early images. Do you think those working class that the working class roots were important to him?
I think so, and he also, in those early days when he was a kid, he did the window displays for the store. He arranged the objects in the window, so people have said, well, there's the forerunner to his late painting style, where he was arranging in the window and on the shelves the objects.
I think he referred sort of half jokingly to that as being an influence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems there's this Chicago tradition, if you think of Studs Terkel or some of the others, of getting a kind of gritty realism and also dignifying the everyday.
Yeah, I think that was also in the 30s and 40s, that was an important stream in the art world that Bullrod rode, you know, that this was an art style that was very much used, this kind of realism.
It sounds like it would make him a natural candidate for Works Progress Administration.
He did at least one post office mural in those programs in the 30s, so he was to take advantage of that too.
And if you look at, I know this is not one of the images we have on our website, but this one called Landscape Near Chicago, which is a kind of an odd, seemingly haphazard collection of items. I'm wondering if you can describe it. Obviously, radio has its limitation, but describe what this would look like.
I guess that what I've described before would maybe make the listener think that, well, this is a sort of a straightforward sort of description of landscape, what you might see on a calendar. But we're looking at an image from the Academy's magazine, Wisconsin People and Ideas, and there's an image, Landscape Near Chicago, 1934, and it's a little more surreal than straightforward portrayal of a scene. I think maybe that's what Emily is kind of referring to. There's a jumble of objects here, and there in the foreground is it looks like a sign from a used car lot or something, all crumpled up. And then
it reminded me of that famous Campbell's soup can.
Yeah, it looks like later. A can label. And then there's a jumble of car parts, an automobile, and someone working on an automobile in front of this odd structure, cinder block structure. It looks like maybe it's a shop for car repair. And then in the background is another structure that looks sort of like a garage. In the background is a fire hydrant. And then to the horizon is just a green landscape. It looks like the Illinois prairie stretching to the horizon and quite a big area of sky. So the overall impression is somehow a little more surreal than you would expect.
Well, there's no effort at perspective, is there? I mean, instead of the illusion of distance of the image falling away as you get from the foreground to the background, it's more stacked up.
Yeah, it's a little more inconsistent in the way things are portrayed in space. It's not a straightforward perspective situation.
And that automobile, and we're talking, this is a 1934 painting, so we're talking 1930s vintage automobiles.
Right.
And the one toward the back there actually looks more like a cartoon image. The one in the front is somewhat more realistic. But as you get toward the back, it's a different style. This is a kind of thing that we seem to see in his works for many years, where you have this blending of styles, the real and the surreal, or the real and the comical even.
Right. There's a stylization of objects that – it's not photorealism. He has a certain way of stylizing, or he has a certain touch that alters, and it has a certain cartoony quality. And I, you know, wonder what in his background where that came from.
Well, and it's not beautifying it. In other words, this is no Norman Rockwell, or it's not the kind of, you know, thing that you could buy in a Hallmark store or something. It doesn't have that postcard effect. It has a slightly disturbing effect, actually, because, you know, it's that junkyard, haphazard, chaotic look that, if it's called Landscape Near Chicago, makes you think things are not altogether that harmonious.
Well, you can only imagine that he actually saw something like that, but also it has a dreamlike quality. There's something about the way the images are juxtaposed and the things that he brings into it. And again, you see that in later works too, where there are these – I hesitate to call them symbols, but there are these images that are all just kind of jumbled together.
And did he have an audience in mind? In other words, was at this point that he's doing this kind of work, is he hoping to sell paintings? Is he aware of public taste?
I think he really wanted to sell his work and to be a successful artist. He came back from the Art Students League and was – one of his first reminiscences is selling his watercolors and drawings in front of the Art Institute in Chicago out there in the park. They would have these little sort of flea markets, and he was able to sell some things for, you know, a couple of bucks, and this was very gratifying to him. I think he was very conscious of his place in the art world, in his career, and wanting to be a professional artist and make a living at it. He supported his family during his whole life, which is quite an heroic kind of
thing. Quite an accomplishment, yes.
It is.
Yeah. Did he have a political bent or a sort of purpose at all behind some of these paintings?
Well, this was the 30s. It was a depression, and there was in the air, there would have been a lot of ferment with all the political ideas. And I didn't get a sense of that from researching his life and reading his letters and looking at his diaries. I didn't get a sense of a really political person, but I think the whole milieu was – it was the Dust Bowl days. It was a depression. There was in the art world, John Stuart Curry and the regionalists in the Midwestern art, there would have been a lot of this kind of feeling that would bubble up.
What he seems never to have embraced, although I guess he maybe – well, he certainly was aware of it and maybe dabbled with abstractionism or abstract art at times, but he really seems to be in a completely different branch of the tree, whatever he's doing.
Yes. Early on, he was suspicious of modernism when he was a student. We have a quote in the gallery in the 1920s. He was really sort of ranting against cubism and some of the other isms that were coming up in the 20s. And throughout his life, he became kind of famous for
almost being a reactionary.
His vocalizing against what he saw as, especially during the 50s with abstract expressionism, he thought this was really a wrong turning. It was simplifying to the extent that art was being made poorer and poorer, and he wanted to make it richer and richer. And he, as you can see in his still lives, he really was interested in a very full kind of art with a lot of narrative, a lot of content, as well as the pictorial aspect. So he became sort of notorious. In interviews, he would sort of rant against pop art and abstraction, abstract expressionism.
I guess the principle behind abstract art is that the object itself is the art. In other words, it's not representing something, it is something. And he seemed to be saying that, well, this idea of something that has this kind of concrete immediacy to it is not enough.
Exactly.
He did want some kind of story or something going on in the image.
Yeah, he was very sophisticated. He absorbed a lot of influences, and his art is very, you know, is the late work is not, they are not really just simple descriptive still lifes either. I guess we'll talk more about them later. But he, I think, was a more complicated person than he's been given credit for.
In the exhibit, you include a picture of him in World War II.
Yeah, we have an image of a wonderful image of Aaron Borod in Normandy with General Patton. General Patton has a really shiny, looks like a black helmet with three stars on it. And he looks like a very powerful, macho sort of person. And Aaron Borod is to the right of him and to his right. And he's looking a little bit diffident and awestruck by this powerful presence.
A lot of people did.
He met Ernest Hemingway in Europe during this campaign. And I think the war was such an amazing contrast to everything that Borod had experienced before. He was in the Pacific Theater early on and then was in Normandy 6 days after D-Day and went to the Pacific as a artist with the War Arts Unit till that was disbanded. Then he worked for Life magazine when he was in Europe. I was able to read his diary and his letters to his wife, Ruth, and it's an amazing odyssey of an artist who's just thrown into the chaos and the bitterness of war, and his descriptions of what he saw in the Pacific are quite amazing. And some people think his later work was a reaction to his experiences of World War II, that he was seeking the safety of everyday objects in the kind of a cozier, more intimate world. But I didn't really get a sense of that overt connection for myself.
Let's look more closely at artist Aaron Borod and his experiences in World War II and the way the war came out in his images when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Radio Waves is Wisconsin Public Radio's e-newsletter. Sign up and you'll receive a monthly email with what's happening at WPR. A subscription to Radio Waves is free and getting it is simple. Just go to WPR.org.
In addition to the privilege of being able to paint the war when there was no contesting subject that had anywhere near this dramatic power, I count it as gain that I was able to be near some of the interesting movers like George Patton and some of the artists and writers who were so close to the pulse of the conflict. I remember having a discussion with Ernest Hemingway, who visited our camp, about his little old aunt I had known in Carbondale. On my reestablishment in Chicago when the war in Europe was over, I worked up a long series of paintings based on war travel. That's Aaron Borod in his autobiography, A Decade of Still Life, from the University of Wisconsin Press, 1966. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Randall Berndt. And Aaron Borod is our subject, that multifaceted artist who, as we'll find out later, mysteriously turned to just one of his many facets and devoted 30 years to it. We've already seen that he was an urban landscape painter, among other things, and he worked for the Works Progress Administration in the 30s, and then in World War II went into that combat artists unit, which was a major turning point in his life. There are a couple of paintings that we see him painting in the early 40s, which are both contrasting and similar at the same time, Randall. There's this one, which is a French urban scape, where the only thing left is a statue of Joan of Arc.
Yes, this painting, I believe, would have been done in Chicago after Borod returned. He based paintings on sketches and quick studies that he'd done in Europe, and this is a statue of Joan of Arc that, again, looks, it's in a ruined, a bombed-out city, a very dark painting, dark sky. Everything is monochrome, and there's some brightening of the sky behind Joan of Arc, but it's a pretty grim, desolate scene without color and would really reflect the extreme downside of his experiences in the war. I mean, there was the excitement of travel and seeing new sights and meeting George Patton and Ernest Hemingway, but I think he saw, both in the Pacific and in Europe, a lot of things that were less than pleasant, and he brought it back to Chicago with him. And then in 1942, we have Oakdale Avenue at night, which again is dark. It would be one of those paintings that he became famous for, contrasting the night with the lights from the window, in this case, of a residence. But this would have been the kind of urban realism that he became nationally known for. And his paintings, these paintings were collected in museums like the Art Institute in Chicago, the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And Borod was very successful in the 40s in galleries in Chicago and New York and established a name for himself as this kind of artist.
How do you interpret this second painting? One commentator says that it's spooky and that you see
it looks
the doorway to this stone edifice opening like some kind of a maw, and you have the lights like eyes all behind this innocent-looking woman who's about to cross the street.
Right. In many ways, it reminds me of art by Charles Birchfield and Edward Hopper, very different kinds of artists, but whose work evokes this sort of feeling. There's a mystery. There's a narrative there that we wonder about. And again, I think it's a very 1940s kind of painting and style and feeling.
Well, and it has a sort of sense of desolation or loneliness. And then I notice even when he gets to Wisconsin and starts doing landscapes like the one called Wisconsin Swamp, he chooses trees with no leaves. It's a kind of bleak landscape. Can you tell us how a man that was so rooted in place, someone who came out of the Chicago area, how did he make that journey to Wisconsin and what did it do to his art?
He was offered in 1948, was offered the Artist in Residence program here in Madison on the UW campus following John Stuart Curry, who had died suddenly in 1946. And indeed, it was a big change for him. He was a city person who I think was a really dyed-in-the-wool urbanite. And to come to Madison must have seemed like he was heading to the boondocks. And he did agonize over it. I read letters. It was quite a drawn-out period in before 1948, before he was accepted to this position. And he didn't know if he was going to get it. And it was a lot of back and forth. And indeed, he did agonize about it because it was such a big change. And as it turned out, after a few years here, his art changed so dramatically that maybe that's symbolic of what a tremendous change this was for him, because he was very comfortable in Chicago. He had a studio on the third floor of a big old house in Chicago, and he had everything that he needed there. And there must have been some part of him that thought that, well, this style that he had worked with was maybe kind of had run its course. Maybe there was time. It was a time for a change, even though, as you say, in his first years in Wisconsin, the style of the paintings, though the subject matter changes, the style is the same. It's loosely painted. It's a funny kind of stylization between realism and a kind of surreal, odd, kind of spooky quality to some of it. And we don't know what it looked like to him or what it was like in the context of the art at the time. That's the way it looks to us now.
I see that you include in your exhibit photos, including one of him visiting a farmer, a Wisconsin farmer. And you talk about his experience sort of as somebody who was supposed to be living out the Wisconsin idea?
Yeah. As I looked at materials, especially photographs of him in this new environment, I wondered how it was for him. As part of the Wisconsin idea, he traveled around the state and talked with farmers, housewives, other people whose avocation was art in some way. And this was in the late 40s, early 50s. He apparently was quite comfortable. I've talked to other artists who accompanied him. Warrington Colescott, who is an artist and teacher here at the university, said he had gone with him on some of these trips, and Borod seemed quite at home with it. So it seems like he adapted and loved to talk to people kind of on their own terms and where the level of their art was for them. But if you see images of him, there's one of him out in the cow pasture with a sketchbook looking at some distant vista facing the camera, and in the background is a herd of cows in the barn. And as I look at him, he's dressed very neatly, and I wonder how the urbanite in him adapted to Wisconsin.
Well, yes, and the fact that, again, coming out of the war experience and the urban experience, it's about as different as it could be. I mean, you know, have this pastoral landscape. And how would he come to terms with that? Did he have students at this point then? And if so, how did he affect them?
No, he did not, for the most part, teach classes here at the university. He didn't. He taught some classes, which we can talk about elsewhere. But he was available in the studio. He had several studios on campus. The one that most people would be familiar with is next to Babcock Hall, where you get the ice cream on campus. His studio is still there, used for a different purpose now. And his door was open and people could come in and he was accessible. He would stop where you talk about his art or where you talk to whomever came in. So he was available. That was a whole Wisconsin idea.
Now, at the same time, he seemed to have this career as an illustrator, too, because in 1955, we get this picture of Frank Sinatra on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah. Again, he was so productive and active in several different realms. He did ceramics. He designed fabric designs. And he had quite a career as an artist illustrator where his work was reproduced, was made for reproduction. And we have some examples in the exhibition of Time covers from the 50s and the early 60s. So that he was much sought after for doing series of paintings that would be reproduced.
He did a Marilyn Monroe cover.
He did a Marilyn Monroe cover, which has disappeared.
Both senses of the word.
I was told about the Time cover that disappeared, that was never used, the Marilyn cover, where he had to make adjustments to her neckline and send the painting back to the publisher. And somehow Marilyn just disappeared. We have another cover, a more demure cover in the exhibition of a painting for the statehood of Alaska.
And we've got some of the images like the Frank Sinatra Time cover on our website, too, for anyone wanting to look at that. You've talked about this turning point moment, this epiphany in his life, shortly after the time we were talking about when he got to Wisconsin and started to do these landscapes like the Wisconsin Swamp one. Tell us what it is that happened and how it changed his art.
I think at the beginning, Norman quoted from his description of the epiphany. In 1953, Borod and his family went to the UP. He was teaching a summer class at Northern Michigan University in Marquette and took classes out to sketch on the shores of Lake Superior. And up there is a very dramatic shoreline with amazing rocks. I just was able to visit up there this last summer, and it's a beautiful, beautiful landscape and shoreline. It's amazing. And Borod came back to Madison with sketches, and he was working from his sketches to make more developed paintings and was frustrated that he couldn't get the kind of detail he wanted, kind of incisive lines, textures, and forms. So he took to holding, in one hand, a pebble or a rock of different sizes and painting with the other hand and looking at the rock to get this detail. And that really amazingly was what triggered his thoughts about going to a kind of art where he would paint directly from objects rather than from other materials like sketches or memory, photographs. He would have objects in front of him and he would paint them. In the beginning, he decided he needed to paint them exactly life-sized.
One-to-one proportions.
And we have an example of that, a Lincoln portrait from the Chazen Museum in the exhibition, which is third in that series, a series that he thought would be sort of a temporary diversion from what he thought of as his real calling in art, but turned out to be a very long-term interest that he never exhausted his interest in.
Take stock here, what at that point, up until that point, did he think was his real calling in art?
Well, again, I think what we've been talking about in terms of American scene painting was pretty much what he thought of as his art, was the description of people in landscapes, cityscapes, a kind of realism that is romantic and subjective and it's loosely painted, very different look to it from the still lifes. The Lincoln portrait is objects. There's a background of vertical pine boards, and you have a ceramic mug, a deer antler, and some other paper objects, envelopes, and a portrait of Lincoln tacked to the boards. And it's a kind of an assemblage of objects that you wonder, what is the connection between these objects? And I think here, early on, Borod was simply making a kind of a conservative, straightforward setup to paint from, to explore how you make a composition and how do you render these objects in light. And it's not as complicated as some of his later work.
If I'm looking at this picture, which has the red feather underneath Lincoln, it has mail behind him, it looks like, post office mail, just different pieces of things, the deer antler and the mug. If I look at that, just on our website and so, but if I'm looking at this picture and trying to understand the gift of Aaron Borod, who's given me this Lincoln portrait, what is it that you see after having studied his work and sort of understood his vision? What is it that you get from this Lincoln portrait?
Well, again, I'm seeing this maybe not in itself, but in contrast to what he did before and what a dramatic leap this was and how he's made this amazing change to rendering these objects just in terms of the artistic adventure that this was for him and the drama of it, seeing the magic of the dimension of these objects and what a wonderful sort of experience that would have been for him.
And it's actually, really, it's a portrait of a Lincoln portrait. Because it's not like just an image of Lincoln. It's an image that has this deliberately flat picture of Lincoln as the center.
Yeah, there's a picture within a picture which often becomes something that he works with later, which is an interesting question of why that fascinated him so much.
Did he have some negative reaction when he sort of all of a sudden started doing this kind of different art?
Oh, yeah. I think people thought they were very puzzled by it. And it would seem like it would have been a big gamble for him to identify himself, as he did more and more, with this – taking the stance of I've made this change and I'm going to stick with it. And he was very tenacious about it and often seemed like he portrayed himself as a loner, unique, and was battling the other trends in art in the 50s and 60s.
But again, you say he didn't really declare that I'm going to be devoting the rest of my career to this. He was just doing one at a time.
Not in 1953. He thought he might do, 10 of these maybe, and then he'd go back to painting in the way that he had been identified with before.
What did he think of some of the artists like, let's say Jackson Pollock or some of the others? I mean, do we know who he was influenced by, what he was reacting against?
Salvador
Dali, for example, and just others. I mean, I'm just curious.
You know, at one point he made a comment about Andy Warhol and said that – and this was a little later in life when he had mellowed a bit and had a little more sense of humor about it and didn't feel quite so embattled. He said, well, Andy Warhol's doing these commonplace objects in transferring them into art, and that he felt that he could at least mention Andy Warhol's name.
Without losing his temper or something like that.
But I think, he did make a lot of comments about slapdash abstract expressionisms like Warhol, like Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning, where this wasn't enough. And in some of his paintings, you'll see where he plays around with paint. He does that, but that's only part of the painting, that there's a lot more going on. So he thought that this was a real impoverishment.
I think there was a term, scatter painting, where I don't know exactly what that refers to, but I assumed that it referred to a kind of an arbitrary application of paint to canvas by some means,
chance.
Whether you use a paintball or other form of missile projection.
Famous for just having the painting down flat on the floor and just...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We heard him referred to as Jack the Dripper.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
We're going to hear the voice of Aaron Borod when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Chippewa Valley Technical College. Openings now available for nano and micro machining tenants at the NanoRite Incubation and Innovation Center. More information at nanorite.org.
I call myself a hard-boiled still-life painter. Other people, more sophisticated people, like to put me into the category of the fool-the-eye painter. They have a fancy French term for it. It sounds like trompe-l'oeil. But I'm always hesitant to use that, primarily because I think I'm not exactly that kind of painter. I have other interests which supersede that of merely... beguiling the eye of the spectator into the belief that he's looking at reality instead of my painted version of reality.
That's Aaron Borod in conversation with John Powell in WHA in 1973, just after his retirement as artist in residence from the University of Wisconsin. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Randall Berndt, who is the co-curator of the James Watrous Gallery at the Wisconsin Academy and has put together a centennial exhibit called Aaron Borod, A Life and Still Life, running through the end of December, showcasing both the life and the work of this American artist with a strong Wisconsin connection. Randall, do you want to comment about that voice we just heard and the comments he makes there?
We've talked a little bit about what his still lifes look like. And again, I would say that they're not just strictly fool the eye. They're not photographic realism. They're more complicated than that, and they have all sorts of little narrative adventures going and little connections between objects. There's a sense of humor in them, and there's a stylization that is Borod's in the way he – there's a certain touch that he has that is a little hard to describe and define that we saw in his earlier work, the Chicago work.
And you have one painting in your exhibit called The Rose that – you give quite a bit of attention to. Can you describe that? It looks a lot more complicated than the Lincoln one that we were talking about.
Exactly. A Lincoln portrait is a much more straightforward, conservative, and almost like a 19th century still life where Borod was finding his way with this style. And in 1963, he does an unusual private commission for the Rowe family, R-O-W-E, Jack and Mary Lee Rowe. It's a kind of the centerpiece for our exhibition, and it's consists of just a pile, a mountain, a conglomeration of objects that he put together from things that they brought to him in his studio. They brought, I think, like five cardboard boxes full of memorabilia and objects, things that they picked up on their travels.
Photographs.
This contains the background, first of all, is bark. It looks like maybe it's oak. Jack Rowe worked at the Forest Products Lab and as a scientist and at that time was working on trying to find out what uses might be made for bark and the chemistry of what's involved in the bark of trees,
well,
I guess.
That's one use he probably didn't anticipate.
No, but he must have brought in some slabs of wood and it became the background for this.
Now, do you mean literally the background, that this is actual bark or it's a painting of bark?
No, this in the still life was actual slabs of oak bark that Borod in his studio set up all these objects and put a light on it, painted the still life set up from that. There's an amazing range of objects. Tyrolean felt hat with those little pins that you get if you're climbing Mount Matterhorn, I suppose.
Yes, that's right.
Then there's a plate from Switzerland, a fabric from India, a geode, an ivory carving.
Postcard looks like there of the seaplane. I mean, it's as either they gave him several boxes of really touristy stuff, or he picked the ones that particularly said tourists.
Well, there's a lot of feeling of travel and adventure, and Jack and Mary Lee did a lot of that. There's also, though, the material from his scientific world. There's a model of a molecule model there. There's some textbooks, and there's that surgical tubing, and there's a meerschaum pipe, and there's a magnifying device. A
couple of leather-bound books.
And is this an oil painting?
This is oil painting on panel. He painted on a very smooth surface to get the detail.
And so would you say that at least as much of the art goes into his choice of which of these objects to include from all those boxes and how to arrange them? Because,
yeah.
And then what does he do as a painter that couldn't be accomplished by just photographing this arrangement he had made of material objects?
Painters love that question.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think was often asked. He fiddled with things. We have some of the objects in the exhibition so you can see what the objects look like. Indeed, the ones we have are pretty straightforwardly rendered. There are some color changes. I think, though, the painting itself is a really different animal from having these things stacked up in front of you. It's quite flattened out. It's an art experience. It's condensed in a way, and you can only look at it one way. Can't walk around it. The light is controlled. He has control of the reflections, the light, and it's a much more complicated world than if you just saw the objects themselves.
It reminds me again of one of the paintings we talked about earlier in the conversation, the Chicago landscape, where everything, instead of coming away from you in perspective, is stacked
up. Piled up.
Yeah, and so you're really channeled into seeing it the way Borod wants you to see it.
And one thing about this painting that was commented by Robert Cozzolino, the curator from the Philadelphia Academy of the Fine Arts, who gave a gallery talk at an opening reception about this painting, was it really relates to a lot of the art movements that Borod at one time was quite hostile to. It's quite a flat painting. Things are piled up and flattened. Everything is in sharp focus from edge to edge. It's a very unnatural way of looking at things. This is not how your eyesight normally works in the natural world. So he's really using some devices that are parallel to other art movements that he felt at one time he was not a part of.
Do we know what Thoreau's thought of this?
Thoreau's loved this painting. Mary Lee Roe still has this in her house. It's a treasured artwork to her. And her way of looking at it is in terms of the objects themselves. She does not analyze the painting in the way that the curator looks at it in terms of its relation to other art. She has this very warm relationship with the artist and with the art. They were personal friends of Borod. And what we tried to do in the exhibition was to show his connection to community, collectors who became friends, and this kind of back and forth relationship between him and them.
Where did he go from here? He's still doing the still lifes, but does he continue to have photographs worked into his still lives?
Oh, yeah. What you see here is really kind of representative of his mature work that from 1963 to 1992, when he passed away, very complicated. Many of them are complicated setups, mixing of, as you say, flat quotes from books, magazines, tear-outs from popular culture, but also references to famous artists, old masters, and high art, mixing high art and kitsch, popular culture. He really was fascinated with that. And I've been thinking of him as kind of a cultural omnivore, where he took and mixed all sorts of images from high culture and what we think of as popular culture. And there was a lot of energy and transaction in those little narratives that he concocted.
Did you find any paintings that he ever did of bowls of fruit? You know, when we think of still lifes in the sort of traditional sense, it's usually a bowl of fruit. Or I'm also just thinking of the exhibit that was at the Chase in the Medici collection of elaborate, you know, very ripe-looking grapes and sort of the cornucopia-looking still lifes.
He did incorporate fruits and vegetables, but often they were not – well, I suppose some of those paintings you're referring to are allegorical and symbolic of something, some narrative that's going on too. But it was always a story, you know, what? Why is the onion next to a reproduction of a Matisse woman with very full breasts?
Maybe? Yeah, yeah, and all those sort of vase-shaped lilies and things.
Yeah, there's a lot of just the shape of things, but also the narrative, the story of how things connected to each other. He was fascinated with the idea of rebus, where things make words.
Letters and images that
make words. Some of the paintings were those kind of playful combinations of things too. So he had a very kind of a literary bent too, which is sort of postmodern in a way, away from the purity of the art object that was so important at one time.
You do see, well, for example, in this painting that he did for the Rose, you have, in addition to the two leather-bound volumes, and I can't quite tell, but I think with a larger image, you could actually read the gilt titles.
Technical.
And then the
textbooks.
The gold-colored plate also has script on it, and you see that same sort of thing in some of his other paintings where there is text worked in a way. You might think it would be distracting because, I mean, I as more of a person of words than images would tend to like, what does that say? You know,
yeah. mixing apples and oranges. Yeah, I think he wasn't afraid of that. And again, the kind of playful nature, the humor, the stories, the narrative threads, I think there's really a lot to look at. But there's also, he was really concerned with composition and texture and placement lights. You can look at them in formal terms also.
What do you think kept him from being more famous? In other words, he was well-known and had a good position as artist-in-residence and was able to support himself and his family from his art. Obviously, he's got this centennial exhibit that acknowledges his place. Yeah. But he's not a household name.
No.
What kept him from that next level?
He was tremendously successful while he was alive. He produced hundreds of paintings, was prodigiously productive. And so his art is out there in collections. People love his work. People felt that they could connect with the work. There wasn't a great intellectual barrier there. I think the question you're asking is a sort of a difficult one to answer. There's a whole series of things that have to come into play in the art world for that to happen in terms of museums, curators, collectors, this whole dynamic of who promotes what. And it's a question that I can't answer.
Well, in order to keep an artist before the public, except through what are really fairly unsatisfactory reproductions. I mean, these in the pamphlets and articles and so on certainly are evocative, but it's not like seeing the real thing for texture or even for color. And short of that, don't you have to just keep mounting exhibitions of the work, which in itself is really quite an undertaking to pack all of those things up? That's assuming you get a venue and somebody to support the whole project.
I think Beaurat deserves a full-scale museum exhibition and a monograph, a book to go with it, which I think eventually he'll get. And Bob Cozzolino, who I've referred to before, the curator at the Philadelphia Academy, has ideas about this artist that would make that kind of exhibition and explore all these complexities. And I'm hoping that happens in the future. We've done kind of a small-scale museum show that gives people a sense of his life and his art, and it's kind of an hors d'oeuvre.
What do you think we would have lost if there had been no Aaron Beaurat? We didn't have any of these paintings. What would be missing?
I think he's a unique artist, and as I research and look more closely at his work, again, I think he was one of a kind, and we would be missing that uniqueness. There's so much in eyes for our attention. You know, just what do you pay attention to? And we're bombarded, you know, with imagery, and it's easy for an artist to be lost.
Did he have artists who came after who were influenced by his work?
I know that there are artists who have painted in his style, and I'm not able to talk about their work that well. I asked Bob Cozzolino that question. Was Beaurat one of a kind?
Was that the end of the line?
Yeah, and I have that feeling that he's unique, and he was a specific, unique person who had these experiences that we've described, this history, this arc to his life story that can't be replicated, you know, his ethnic background, where he grew up, and the experiences he had.
Well, it is a fascinating trajectory from those early urban scapes to the World War II combat images and then to get into still lifes for the last half of his career. It's really been quite interesting for us to follow those trends, and many of them seem to just come from the mind of the artist, and you can never know exactly what sent him off in one direction or another.
And you have a great picture of him in his studio on your exhibit brochure.
Yeah, we have him in 1985 in his Monona studio, which kind of gives you a sense of what his world was like. There's a lot of stuff in his studio, and there's a couple of paintings there, and it's studio images of artists are wonderful. You kind of can enter their world a little bit.
The name of the exhibit is Aaron Beaurat, A Life and Still Life. It's at the James Watrous Gallery at the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison, and the co-curator has been with us for this hour. His name is Randall Burnt, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Thank you. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, why did Wisconsin have two governors at the same time? And why was Chicago given to Illinois instead of Wisconsin, which was the original plan? Those answers, and others too, next Sunday afternoon at 4 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.